ain't afraid of no ghost. Don't get caught alone, no, no.
Ghostbusters!
When it comes through your door, unless you just want some more, I think you better call.
Hunting Haunts, a Ghostbusters podcast. As always, I'm your host, Adam, and with me is my co-host, Donnie. Donnie, how's it going?
What's up, Ghostbuster fans? It's the inventor of the pink Ecto Slime milkshake. It's the Emerald Enthusiast.
Or, conversely, it could be called Pepto-Bismol, but that's not...
I remember when Ghostbusters 2 came out, I was like, that's what they should have, is a pink Ecto Slime milkshake.
Yeah, I mean, the marketing possibilities are endless. And if we haven't given it away yet, or if it hasn't become obvious yet, the topic of our discussion today will be Ghostbusters 2, the 1989 sequel to the 1984 original. Before we actually get into the, you know, the meat and potatoes of the discussion, it's funny that I say, as always, your host, Adam, we've only done one episode of this, so why would it change after one episode? But anyway, that's just a force of habit of me saying that. But, I mean, there's not a hell of a lot of Ghostbusters news to bring anybody at this stage of the game. However, we do have an idea that they are done. They are pretty much done work on the film. The film is pretty much almost locked and ready to go, Donnie.
Yes.
Ghostbusters Afterlife, I mean, obviously. Ghostbusters 2 is locked.
Right,
it's,
yeah.
It's been locked since 1989.
Right, but, just for clarification.
Yeah, I mean Ghostbusters Afterlife, but I mean, the scheduled date is summer 2021, but so we're not, I mean, we're not going to see it in the next, you know, month or two, but knowing that it's done, it's pretty exciting, wouldn't you say, Donnie?
Oh, very much so, especially since there's not very much new entertainment right now, just these little tidbits of news that are coming out about productions being finished, about, you know, tentative dates. Those kinds of things are exciting right now since, again, there is so much upheaval in the world and we don't know how things are going to be dispersed as far as entertainment. And that's part of the reason that we're bringing you these podcasts, is because we're a little short on entertainment these days, at least new entertainment. So we figured that we would bring you this kind of stuff on the Multiverse Musings Podcast Network.
Right. And I mean, great plug. But I mean,
shameless plug.
Yeah, very shameless, but it works. I mean, we'll be bringing, of course, as we get the new content, we'll be bringing you our thoughts on that new content as well. But in the meantime, why not look back and share our thoughts on the content of our favorite franchises from prior years. So while we wait to review the new content for you, after we've seen it, of course, we will happily go back and take a look at past entries into our most beloved properties. So, as we wait for that day in summer of 2021, where we are sitting down watching Ghostbusters Afterlife, we will reminisce about Ghostbusters 2. So, Donnie, what do you remember from your hype level and experience upon going to see the movie?
Well, I would have been 16 at the time. This was the summer of 1989. And I remember being just really very excited about this because that was a time back in the 80s when sequels weren't a given. And there weren't really a lot of franchises to speak outside of a lot of, like, you know, your horror movies like, you know, like Friday the 13th, a lot of big blockbusters. It was, they would make the movie, a big movie, release it, see what the reception was, test the waters for a sequel, and you may or may not get it. There were a lot of successful movies back then that didn't get sequels. So it wasn't a given that there would be a Ghostbusters 2. And when I heard about it, again, I was very, very excited that we were going to get to see the whole crew again. And they got back pretty much all the actors from the film, from the first film. And that really excited me, too, that we weren't going to see a bunch of recasts or in any way a cheaper version, a cash grab. It was going to be something that would honor the first film. So what was your impression?
Well, it's funny because much like the first one, I had seen it for the first time on television. Because again, we're talking 1989, right?
Yes, summer of 1989.
Right. So I would have been 6. And it wasn't a scenario of, you know, now where back when we could go to the theater and see movies, you know, I can go because I have my own income and stuff like that. I can go see as many blockbuster movies as I want. Back then it was, you know, your parents got to take you. So they're not going to take you every week or every 2 weeks or even every month to go see a big movie. Back then it was, we're picking and choosing about which ones we go to. And summer of 89 for me was the summer of Batman. So
no doubt.
That's the one I was fixated on. That's the one I saw. And yes, I've dragged them to see it more than once. So that was the one that I was seeing. So anything else that summer or that year, for that matter, was, you know, to use the acronym SOL, right? Yeah. So you know, Ghostbusters was a, and by the way, the year later, 1990, was Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Just if anybody was wondering. But that was the movie of the summer. That was the big blockbuster I saw. But so for Ghostbusters, much like the first one, I just saw it when I caught it on TV, and I was happy there was another one because
I actually think I took a date to this movie. I just can't remember her name. So
I'm sure whoever she is broken up over that fight.
Yeah, but I know for a fact that even though I can't remember her name or really exactly which theater I went to, I do remember seeing it in the theater, but I just have a vague impression. But I'm sure she's
just to be safe for your sake, the person you can't remember the name of was not, did not obviously end up being your wife, correct?
No, definitely not. I did not meet her until many years later.
Okay, good. So you won't lose a limb tonight because of the way you said in this podcast. I'm glad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Good to know. But so, and just to be clear, this person that you took to the movies was clearly not a From the First Kiss to the Last situation. Clearly. So let's also put that out there.
I'm not even sure if there was a first kiss there.
But it was just from the first the first roll of film to the last, I guess.
Yeah. But if I got, maybe it was a holding hand situation. I don't remember.
Okay. From the first clasp of the hands to the last. There we go. I can work it in with anything as proof of many of the podcasts I do. But so yeah, for me it was a you know home viewing, and look, I'll just come out and say it. I know this film gets a lot of flack and a lot of, I don't know if hate is the right word, but just general reaction to. But I enjoyed it. I enjoy it. I still to this day enjoy it. You know, rewatching it, I had fun with it. That's my, you know, my non-spoilery thoughts.
Oh, I'm in full agreement. It's hard to catch lightning in a bottle twice. And the first film had so many elements that came together and worked that it was going to be difficult to capture that for a second time. But I will say, even though this didn't earn the type of money that the first one did, it didn't get the warm reception that the first one did, I think that it's a very fitting, a very competent addition to the Ghostbusters mythos.
Now, when did the film come out? Like, what was the month?
It was June 1989, at least in the States, if I remember correctly.
So that was the same month as Batman came out, right? If I remember correctly, if my math.
Yeah, that's a good question.
I'm gonna look up when Batman came out. I'm pretty sure it was June. And if that's the case, then Ghostbusters has nothing to be ashamed of, or Ghostbusters 2, of essentially, you know, being second to Batman.
Indeed, it was June 1989.
Right. So, yeah. And like, if you think about it, like, and wasn't Raiders of the Lost Ark as well, or one of the Indiana Jones movies out in that year as well? So there was a lot, that, you know, that, those are three, now by nowadays standards, three big franchises, or, you know, vying for attention. In back then, it was three big releases vying for attention. So, I mean, really, Ghostbusters 2 didn't have the same luxury as the first one did of sort of being, you know, the wow factor in the theater at the time, as it did in 84, you know, when it was released. So, you know, there are different circumstances, but again, like you said, it's entertaining. I found some of the jokes even funnier, as Donnie will attest to the message I sent him last night.
yes.
and yeah, it's a very valued entry into the franchise. As I would venture to say, all three of them were, to be honest.
Yes, I would say so too. I enjoyed all three of the theatrical releases a lot. So,
right, yeah.
Yeah. Obviously, that's why I'm on a podcast like this, because I have been watching those on a regular basis for, since the 80s. So.
Yeah, so with our non-spoilery early thoughts out of the way, all right, Donnie, give us some, where do you want to start with this film? Where do you want to?
Well, let's start at the beginning. The shot opens up in New York. Mm. And we see the first thing we see is some pink ecto-slime coming up out of the sidewalk. And not long after that, we see a familiar face, and that is Dana. Mm-hmm. And this time she has a not so familiar face, and that is a baby named Oscar. Mm-hmm. So, do you remember what your impressions were of that scene, Adam?
Well, I had a good laugh. I shouldn't laugh, because in the world of the film, the baby was in some sort of jeopardy. But it was kind of funny seeing that baby carriage caused so much havoc of, like, traffic is in shambles. The dog walker, you know, lost sort of control of his dogs. You know, it's just utter chaos. And, I mean, that baby was, and you come to find out later in the credits, it was two twins. But
yes, yes.
But, you know, those babies, let's say, were absolutely adorable in terms of that. So, But I like the fact that it opens on a familiar face being Dana. And I remember as I got older, one of the first things I thought was, is that Peter's kid? That was like, upon the opening scene, that was my thought process. Of course, later we find out that it was not. But that was my opening thought process.
Which I think, you know, if there's a... I don't have a lot of criticisms of this movie, but I think they could have had a plot that revolved around it that way instead of having this unseen other man that Dana Barrett married. But that's just my opinion, so...
Right. But then again, to be fair, we did see... we did see the other man plot in Superman Returns, and we actually saw the other man, aka Cyclops, and that guy just has, you know, bad luck in terms of comic book franchise, because he always ends up playing second fiddle, first to Wolverine, then to Superman. But anyway, and whoever Dana's love interest would have played second fiddle to. Would have actually been fourth fiddle, because it would have been Venkman and the other three Ghostbusters, and then people would have cared about him. But I see your point.
Well, and then there was Lewis, which was a relationship arc that, when we get to that part of the movie, I'll say that I actually did enjoy that. So
as did I. We'll get there. But what I found really interesting, Don, was the state of the Ghostbusters at the start of the film, and that is to say, there is no Ghostbusters. They've basically disbanded.
Yes, we learned that that business went bad, and there really was no more Ghostbusters. And after the scene where the baby is weaving in and out of traffic like Walter Payton due to some supernatural disturbance here, we see the Ghostbusters at a kid's party, at least Peter and Winston, Ray and Winston, at a party, trying to do a song and dance for the kids who actually have someone else in mind. They're chanting, "We want He-Man."
Right, and you know what? I can't argue with them. Yeah. Because as a kid, I wanted He-Man too.
Yeah. There's another movie that I saw in the theater that would have been, I guess, 1987, that nobody liked that I loved.
I mean, you know, you listen to the I Have the Power of He-Man podcast.
Oh, yes.
Which is part of the Multiverse Physics Podcast Network.
Available on iTunes and Podbean.
How many shameless plugs are we going to get in here before this review is over? But no, I love that movie. But again, I agree with the kids, because He-Man, when I was a kid, was a staple in my household. I had all the toys.
Likewise.
I don't have them anymore, unfortunately, due to circumstances, which I won't get into, because I've belabored that point over and over on several podcasts. My poor mother's getting sick of hearing that story. she's in fact told me to get over it many a time. So here we are.
My mother apologized for throwing away a Superman comic book that I don't even remember. She was like, "Yeah, I told you to pick it up and you wouldn't do it. I told you like five times and you didn't do it, so I threw it away." She's like, "I'm so sorry." And I was like, "I don't remember that." So that's nothing to be sorry about.
My mom was like, basically she said, "You know, it went to, you know, the less fortunate," which of course I'm all for. "You're now 37 years old. Get over it." that was the extent of my rebuttal was, "All right, I got my own money. I'll rebuy those toys."
There you go. But she doesn't quite understand nerd rage, does she?
No, it doesn't compute. I can't argue with the kids' sentiments. You know what I like? What made me laugh with this scene upon rewatching it is Jason Redman, right?
Right.
Is the kid, or is one of the kids at the party? Is it his party? I can't remember.
I don't remember exactly which kid. You know, I just remember that, you know, the Ghostbusters, you know, doing their famous catchphrase, you know, "Who are you going to call?" And the kid's going, "He-Man, He-Man." Yeah.
No, but then Jason Redman goes up to them and says, "You know, I think he says, my dad says you guys are losers.
Yeah, he calls them. I can't remember exactly the dialogue now, but he was like, yeah, he says that, you know, you guys are a sham, and that's why you lost your business.
Yeah, and so it's kind of funny that then the son of the director has a line saying, my dad thinks you guys are a sham. so that, you know, there's the double entendre there. And then basically, the current director of the franchise is basically telling them they're losers, which I find, you know, the meta aspects of that are hilarious.
Yeah. And I like later on when Ray and Winston are outside on the street, Ray calls them ungrateful little yuppie larva, which that was, as I got older, that was funnier to me than the first time I heard it.
it is pretty funny. So again, so we've got them attending the party. Venkman is hosting a TV show about psychics.
Yeah, World of the Psychic.
Yeah. Where, you know, he calls them all for being shams, but let's be honest, remember the first film when he was trying to get into that woman's pants by making her seem like she had psychic abilities while shocking the boyfriend. So, I mean, it's like the pot calling the kettle black in a way. And then we have Ray, of course, manning his bookstore, his occult bookstore. And Egon is back at the university, or at a university, doing his things with you know, spores and science and all those things. So that's where they are. The Ghostbusters are defunct. And then, lo and behold, Dana's situation with her baby is what brings them sort of back together. And that's where we kind of learn the fate of the relationship to that point of Dana and Peter.
Yeah. We see that's Ray's occult books that we see them get together. And after that, we see them end up at Dana's apartment. And that's when we see, you know, kind of the reunion of Peter and Dana. And that's when we kind of learn the backstory that their relationship didn't work out. And so she got married and now that's over. And so we kind of see the, you know, the plot line again of, you know, the will they or won't they scenario with their relationship.
Yeah. And you know what, actually, what I actually liked seeing Donnie was
seeing Mr. Brell from No Holds Barred showing up from the No Count Bar.
Actually, no, but that's a good pull.
there's another movie that I liked that nobody else liked.
No Holds Barred, loved it. that's where we got Zeus, right?
Exactly, Tiny Lister. Yep.
The cool thing that I like seeing was watching Peter interact with the baby. Because you see a human vulnerable side to him.
Yeah, you know, and I always wonder what babies think about the actual actors or actresses, I guess, but babies that are in a movie like that and hear all these adults saying things to them that they can't possibly understand and, you know, doing things to them. The baby, it's funny sometimes to look at the baby and the baby, you could tell the baby is like, what is going on here? But back to your point, yes, they all kind of fawned over Oscar, who was just adorable. Both of the twins who, or well, I don't know, twins, brothers, whatever, who played him. But yeah, those were some really heartwarming scenes.
Absolutely. And again, it really shows that there's more to Peter than the attitude, the bravado, the male chauvinism kind of aspect of him. And so I like seeing that. It's actually funny watching him try to maintain his facade of arrogance while being opening up with the baby and stuff. That makes it funnier. And then speaking of that arrogance and that you know, perverse and sexism and stuff, comes my favorite line, one of my favorite exchanges in the movie that had me in stitches. I actually spit up some water as I was drinking and watching the movie. Because I'm not one of those guys that remembers every single quote from every, every scene in the movie. So they're analyzing the Oscar's bedroom, right? Ray and Egon. And then Peter comes in and says, "What do we got?" And, you know, Ray goes through some scientific mumbo jumbo. And then Egon says, "I'd like to do a gynecological examination of the mother." And then Peter goes, meaning Dana. And Peter responds with, "Who wouldn't?" And at that moment, that's when I lost the water.
Well, yeah. That it was meant to make you laugh, and that one got me too.
And another funny scene, once they make the connection, and it's all connected, to borrow a phrase from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., to the Pepto-Bismol slime, like the what's going on with the baby has to do with the slime.
Yes.
And as we realize that the slime is affected by essentially the mood, almost like it reacts to the mood, kind of. It's almost like mood slime, like a mood ring.
They actually do call it that at one point, mood slime.
Yeah. And so you see the Ghostbusters, they're doing an experiment, and they're showing it via the toaster, right?
Yes.
And the whole scene with the toaster, where Peter's ripping them about, "Is this what you do with your nights off? Like, this is what you guys do?" I was dying. It was hilarious.
I really like the scene not long after that where they were digging right before they found the river of, the pink ecto slime, where they were digging to hear Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd do their thick New York accents.
Oh, yeah, and when they were just trying to throw us and send to the police. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they're like, "Yo, can't you see I'm walking here?" It was awesome.
Yeah, and Egon is so out of touch with, like, the then modern, the modern slang.
Yeah.
But it's hilarious. But also, there's another aspect of the plot regarding the slime that we have to touch on. So, and that involves Dana's place of employment, correct?
Yeah. Yes, and that is I'm forgetting the name of the museum now, but that is where the painting of Vigo is.
Yes. Now, what I like about this is that her boss, every time I hear an IKEA commercial, I think of this guy.
Janich? Yeah.
Yeah. You know the IKEA voice?
Yeah.
Every time I hear that commercial with that guy's voice, with the voice, I think of this character. Like, it's unmistakable. I can't help it. And the other part I liked about it was the painting and the way, the way the spirit of Vigo is in the painting.
Yeah, that's very interesting. That reminiscent of another horror novel that I like, that's Rose Matter by Stephen King. I always think about the other when I'm watching Ghostbusters 2, or if I'm reading Rose Matter, because it has another, living painting in it. And always, the one echoes the other for me, so.
Yeah, but just the effects on how the eyes move, right? And how, at some point you see the face coming out of the, you know.
Yes, yes.
Sort of protruding out of the painting like a 3D effect.
Yes.
That was, I mean, it was really well done. And considering, you know, the state of where we were with visual effects in 1989, that was top tier stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's like I mentioned on the pilot episode of this. There are no effects in this that take you out of the story. There's nothing that's so cheap that it will, you have to suspend disbelief. They keep you in this universe, in this world the whole time, despite it being only 1989.
Yeah. So let's just go over what, how does, just to give our refresher for our listeners who probably haven't seen, you know, didn't haven't watched them in a while. How do the slime, the Pepto slime and Viggo tie together? Just give a little bit of a refresher on how that works.
Yeah. Well, that is, you see there's a river of slime that Ray sees, and Viggo is actually drawing energy off of the emotions of New Yorkers, and in particular the negative energy of New Yorkers, and that is what is going to power him up to give him entrance into the world.
Yeah, right.
Did I explain that well enough?
It makes sense to me.
Okay.
So he's going to use the baby, Oscar, as his physical form.
Yes, he's going to inhabit the baby. He's going to, you know, pull a child's play with Chucky and inhabit the baby, and that is going to be his physical form in the world. So,
right. So that was, again, it was a straightforward plot. It made sense in the context of the world we were viewing. And when I say this, I mean, had Viggo accomplished his plan, the stakes for the world would have been very dire.
Oh, yes. Well, and we see early in the courtroom scene, the Scolari brothers get summoned by a small sample of the slime. Right. And that was too, yeah. Yeah, so, and yeah, it could have been bad news. So.
I want to talk about that in some of my favorite scenes, but what I mean to say is, had he accomplished his plan, it would have been bad news. But I think where people give this film some flack is because the first film, the stakes feel huge, and you see that grand scale disaster on full display. With this film, the stakes feel as they're being described, right?
Yes.
Less end of the world. I mean, even though if he does get back into our world, they will be end of the world. But on the surface, it's just this evil megalomaniac, right? Wanting to re-enter our world and cause havoc. There's a difference between saying that, verbalizing that, right, and showing it on a grand scale. And I think that's a key difference of the two films, and that's why people unfairly, you know, rag on this one, because you have to put, you know, 1 + 1 = 2 to get to that grand scale, you know, big moment. You know what I mean? It makes sense what I'm saying.
Well, and you know, it's hard to replicate a villain right. as memorable yeah. as Gozer, and right. so yeah. they kind of had an impossible task. But yeah. I thought that Viggo, especially, you know, some of the things that they say that he did in his lifetime, and when they say that it was his head that actually spoke right before his death, "Death is but a door, time is but a window, I'll be back." Okay, that's pretty freaking ominous.
Yeah. Yeah, right. But what I'm saying is why people, the reason why I think this gets more flack is because in that first film, you see, you basically see the end of the world happening. Like, you're seeing it play out. And the Ghostbusters, you see them stopping it. Before that grand, before Viggo can actually fully form, get through, and cause that level of chaos, he stopped. So I think that's where the discrepancy comes in, with some viewers thinking, well, because they didn't show me that grand, that level of grand scale, that's why I'm going to give it a knock it more so and say it's less than. But I'm not saying it is. I'm just saying how I think people, some people perceive it and why they perceive it to be that way.
And also I'll say this too, visually, and I did like the visuals for Viggo. Maybe he didn't have the same visually memorable appearance with everything and everything around him as the climactic battle in the first movie.
Right. Yeah.
So a lot of people say, yeah, it's a step down, and maybe there's a little validity to that, but I still think it holds up well.
No, I will say though, in terms of like just creepy and like this guy would actually scare me, I think Viggo is worse. Like he looks more ominous and creepy.
Oh yes, and he has the power to, you know, entrance people and, you know, inflict his will on them. You know, he gives Ray the Bray Wyatt eyes and instantly takes him over. So
like like, to me, just looking at him, Gozer looks like either a background dancer at a Madonna concert or a Boy George cosplayer. So, I mean, like, on the surface, before he starts causing stuff, he's not physically intimidating. He's not scary in any way, shape, or form from a visual standpoint. Whereas Viggo, I think, is. Like, you just look at him and you're creeped out. Look at that painting. Look at that painting for 5 minutes and tell me you're not creeped out by that.
Oh, yes. Try to sleep in a room with a painting like that in it. I dare you.
I would absolutely not. So, I mean, it's just a different... The way they approached the villain is a little different. And so, but I don't think... Because they didn't show me this end of the world chaos on full display, that is necessarily a detriment.
No, I think it worked. I think it worked out very well.
Personally, now I really liked all the underground, like when they were in the sewers or the abandoned train station. Like the ghost train, that was so cool to me. Like, I love that.
Yes.
I just love that. Any of those scenes are great, and here's why. Because it reminds you as a viewer that the Ghostbusters concept is that these are the, you know, these workmanlike individuals. Like they're everyday workers.
Yes. Even though they're exceptionally smart too, again, these aren't guys. They're in a field where you really can't have training that much. I mean, they've invented things and they're going out and doing this because it's you know, a passion of theirs. And by the way, like train, his reaction when the train goes through him, his facial expressions are priceless.
Yeah. I mean, like. I got news for you. If I see a train coming at me and not knowing whether it was really there or a ghost train, I mean, either would scare the piss out of me. But I probably have to go home and change my outfit because, you know, like I said, the prospect of, oh my God, it's a real train, it's going to hit me. Or then realizing, oh my God, it's a possessed ghost train.
Yeah, either way, I'm like, the ghost train, that doesn't make it a lot better. I mean, like, I guess
I
you're alive.
But... okay, technically I'd rather be the ghost train because it going through me is not going to turned me into you know, roadkill. But it's still unsettling either way you slice it in that moment. It's still unsettling. But I always like those scenes that remind you that this is not the Justice League or the Avengers, that these are workmanlike people with no enhanced, you know, abilities.
Good point.
I love that aspect of it. So let's talk about it.
Okay.
The relationship between Janine and Lewis.
Yes. Which I thought was hilarious. And by the way, in case, you know, for those of you who may need a refresher, Lewis actually comes to the defense of the Ghostbusters. He is their lawyer in the court when they are charged with, of course, many different things stemming from, you know, breaking up the ground of the city and doing that drilling. And he is the worst lawyer ever. He obviously doesn't know what he's doing as a defense lawyer. But, of course, that doesn't matter because the Scoleri brothers show up because the psychoactive mood substance, the mood slime, reacts. And, of course, we see them. And but that's how Lewis, who, again, another great character, that's how he's reintroduced into this movie.
Now, my question, you brought up the legal aspect of it. Why did it take 5 years to bring these charges to bear?
Weren't the charges specifically from the, you know, again, the incident in movie?
In movie one?
Again, I thought that this had to do with them, like, basically illegally drilling on the street. You know, they caused the blackout, and
I thought that was all based on movie one, personally.
Okay, I'd have to go back and like rewatch that part. You know, maybe I was just zoning out. And no, I thought they were saying that, and maybe it was a little bit of both.
Could have been, but I for whatever reason I thought the trial stuff came before that drilling scene.
Am I missing the order? I thought that came afterward.
One of us is messing things up, but either way,
it's possible.
My point is, if it was based on the original movie, why did this, the events of the original movie, why did this court case take so long to present, you know, to play itself out? So maybe I am wrong, but 5 years seems excessive.
Yeah.
For a court case to. Then again, I'm not a legal person, so I like, maybe these things do take that amount of time. I
really think that it had to do with, again, the blackout and the property destruction, because I do remember them mentioning property destruction, like willful destruction of property as one of the charges. So I think
it wouldn't be the first time that I was wrong, so it could very well be. But here we are.
I thought I was wrong once, but I was mistaken. So
either way, it's it's all good. But I gotta say, I like those two characters because they're so quirky, and so Lewis and Janine being together, it makes sense to me. Like, I'm not gonna ship them or create fan fiction over it, but you know, or like create a Twitter stan account for these two people.
By the way, that word did not exist back in 1989 in that form.
But there was a ship. Oh, wait a minute, though. To be fair, there is a ship in this movie.
There is a ship in this movie, and it is very funny. But
the ghost version of Titanic, which is great.
Ship was not a verb in 1989. How about that?
The good old days. Thank you. Can I go back to the days where shipping did not exist? I mean, in this form? And Michael Keaton was Batman. Well, technically, we are going back to the Michael Keaton as Batman days. Now, can we remove this idea of shipping from the lexicon? And I would be a really happy person. I must tell you.
I have to say this, as far as the funniest line in the movie, to me, it was when Janine and Lewis are, you know, connecting for the first time, and she kind of throws her leg over him, I just remember they were in Dana's apartment, and she was like, "I want to have a baby," and he was like, "Tonight."
Yeah, that was pretty funny. But I mean, hey, she was She was very suggestive with her placement of that. What kind of ball is that?
Exactly. I know exactly what you're saying. Where she kind of put it. How do I keep this PG? Anyway, she put it between her knees, and she made it clear to him that she was very interested. She was very.
I thought to myself, wait a minute.
She was forthright with her body language. How about we say it that way?
Yeah, well, no, I mean, that's very well put. That's expertly put. I liked it, actually. If next time I see something like that, I'm going to use that. But I, as I'm watching it, I thought to myself, I don't think they could do a scene like that today without getting complaints about it online.
Well, they would definitely have to. They would have to evaluate the rating. I think you'd have problems. Was this PG or PG-13? Now that I think about it, I can't remember. But
I don't know. But I don't think it get. I don't think it would get a PG rating for sure nowadays. Yeah. And I will say on the subject of, you know, Janine and her forthrightness or whatever you want to call it, however you phrased it. Janine in this movie is looking quite appealing, I must say. And I'd venture to say that she could potentially make the list based on movie two. And by the way, folks, this is actually stuff I think of as I'm watching the movie. So if I don't remember what place the courtroom scene took place, this is probably why, because I started thinking about the list. And where would Janine from movie two place? Because she's looking quite attractive in this movie. And good for Lewis. He became a Ghostbuster, and he got some action. I don't know if they're the best babysitters in the world, but
definitely not. But I will agree with you. Obviously, I mean, they made her very beautiful in this movie. You know, the glasses and her hair. Yeah, they definitely kind of glammed her up a little bit in her own unique way. Yeah, and, yeah.
I mean, she wasn't like overly exposed. Like, they didn't.
No, there was nothing, you know, indecent. So
they didn't go that far, but it just, I was like, oh wow, it's the same person. I mean, really? And I love, speaking of Lewis, his Ghostbusters, you know, quote unquote suit up moment. What was like? They're doing that play on the epic superhero suit up, even though that didn't exist. I mean, it sort of just started with the Batman, you know, or right. It was just going to start with the Batman movie. So, but yeah, when he was doing that, I'm like, this is a total superhero suit up moment, right? And it's like, it was hilarious.
Yeah, and it was funny because she looked at him and she was like, oh, you look so great in that.
Yeah. But yeah, I couldn't stop laughing. I gotta say, in the way that the Ghostbusters come up with the idea that they come up with to then turn the mood slime into something that could be advantageous to them.
Yes, to positively charge it to be something they can use, then use it as a weapon.
Is very clever.
Yes, yes.
Because what they try to do is they try to make all of New York feel positive and lovingly and unified. And they do that by blaring, which song was it? It's a great song. What was the damn song?
All that's echoing in my head now is the Bobby Brown song, which, by the way, don't we see Bobby Brown in the movie? Isn't he a doorman?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And so they're playing the song. I think it was Higher. Wasn't it Higher?
See, I'm the wrong person to ask about music, because I forget music instantly, so.
I'm pretty sure it was, but anyway.
I just remember that moment at the end where everyone is singing, it reminds me of that scene in Elf. You know, the best way to spread Christmas cheer is singing loud for all to hear.
Right, exactly.
Evidently, that works in more than one way.
Apparently, but like, and so there was the music blaring through the speakers, and then you have them traversing through New York City inside the Statue of Liberty. So the Statue of Liberty is basically walking through New York City, much like the Stay Puft Man did.
Yes.
But instead of destroying it, it's trying to save it.
Yeah. And I'll say this, I still think that might be my favorite Ghostbusters moment, when they figure out that they can do that. And of course they have to do that to break into the museum, because it's, you know, Viggo has basically put up this wall of slime and it's impenetrable to, you know, the proton packs. And so they figure out, we need this, you know, we need to do this. Not only, it's not only something that we need to do, you know, to break through that, but we need to unite New York with a bunch of positive energy. And they, of course, they use the Statue of Liberty, which is a stroke of brilliance, because obviously, you know, the Statue of Liberty is easily identifiable as a New York, statue. So
right, but it looked really good, like the visual of the Statue of Liberty walking through the city like that looked great.
And it was a feel-good moment. It was, you know, you come down here and mess with New York, and New York will mess with you back. That's what I remember at 16 thinking that. So
right. It had the same feel. I remember getting that same feeling in the first Spider-Man movie, right? When on
the bridge with all the New Yorkers on the bridge. And they're trying to distract the Green Goblin. Yes.
Yeah, so I got that same kind of feels there, to quote the kids. And I was
the feels.
Shits and fields. I don't know.
Well, you know, one of the things that I remember thinking was, you know, about two-thirds of the way through the movie, the Ghostbusters are locked up to keep them away from the mayor, which was a great callback scene, by the way.
Yeah.
But I thought to myself, I was like, didn't you learn anything from Terminator? When somebody who has, you know, proven themselves, you know, believable, when they tell you the big baddie is coming and the world is going to end, you don't lock them up in, you know, a psychiatric ward. You believe them and do something about it.
Right. But also, did it not seem to you that a lot of people had seemingly forgot what happened the first time around?
Yeah, because I, you know, when they used the proton packs at the beginning of, you know, the climactic scene, everybody booed when they didn't work. So it was almost like the Ghostbusters had to prove themselves to New York again.
Yeah, it's like, you know,
yeah,
just 5 years ago we saved the world from absolute, you know, hell on earth, and you guys don't trust us. So when he calls the kids, you know, and what do you call them? Ungrateful.
Yes, ungrateful little yuppie larva.
Yeah, I mean, you could apply that to the rest of society, apparently, because you know, they just as bad forgot about what happened. So, like I said, everything surrounding that third act with the Statue of Liberty, I loved it, because it was so juxtaposed to what happened in the first one, where the first one you could blame, you know, Ray dreaming up that Stay Puft Man caused a lot of chaos, a lot of destruction. So here they're accomplishing the reverse.
Yes.
So I like that juxtaposition.
And you mentioned another one of my favorite moments earlier, when that third act comes around, we see the Titanic come in.
Yeah.
Which I thought was just a stroke of brilliance. And it wasn't, Cheech Marin was, you know, one of the actors there. And it was like, yeah, the Titanic's come in. He's like, well, better late than never, I guess.
Yeah, I couldn't stop laughing. I'm like, and when I saw the Titanic, I'm like, oh yeah, I'm like, I forgot that this happened. And I was like, you know, that, whatever, 3 seconds that it was on screen.
Yeah.
Was more entertaining and enjoyable to me than the 3 hours that was the Titanic movie.
Yeah. You know, I went and saw Titanic. I remember that. I don't think I saw it in the theater, but I remember thinking to myself, I'm like, I know how this movie ends. You know, they show up in Ghostbusters 2. So
No,
this is a prequel.
I have an even easier synopsis of the Titanic. And I used to tell people this because the fervor around that movie was insane.
Yes,
every time I used to hear people talking about, oh, I can't wait to go see it. I say, here, I'll save you 3 hours. Spoilers. The ship hits the iceberg and it sinks. The end.
Exactly. If it's so good, let's see them make a sequel.
And my thing is, you know, I'll be honest with you. I caved and saw that movie and I'm just going to leave this here. I saw that movie for two reasons, and I'm stopping right there. You'll know what I'm talking about.
I know exactly. And again, we're going to try to keep it PG here.
I'm just going to leave it there and move along. The Titanic moment was great. But you know what other moment that I really thought really showed off the visual effects?
What was that?
When IKEA boy there was basically levitating baby Oscar in a levitating baby carriage away to Vigo. The visual.
Oh yes, when Oscar is kidnapped.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was some great effects. And Oscar on the ledge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have a fear of heights, that scene must have caused all kinds of.
That scene actually was pretty disturbing, as well as, you know, when the Ghostbusters were down in the sewer, the heads on the pikes.
Yeah.
Kind of a callback to, you know, the way Viggo was in his earthly life. Yeah, there were some, you know, pretty apprehensive moments in this.
Right. And then when the other, so there was the heads on the pike, which was kind of actually scary, you know, like a jump scare. The other one that looked really freaky, like for the brief time that we saw, was when Viggo temporarily inhabits, was it Ray?
Yes, it was Ray at the end. He gives him the Bray Wyatt eyes. And, you know, kind of jumps into him, yeah.
Although there was no Alexa Bliss in this scene, which was kind of disappointing.
I don't think she was born quite yet, or she was a baby.
Probably not, but man, she plays a good psycho, I'll tell you that much. But that's neither here nor there. But, like, the Ray Viggo morphed face was really freaky looking.
Oh, like, yes.
That's
disturbing.
And I like the end.
By the way, we were 2 years away from Alexa at that point. So, anyway.
Oh, all right. Yeah. Good to know, because she's on the list. And, you know, I shouldn't know these details. I'm telling you, I'm going to get an email with a restraining order. I can't even mention her name anymore. She's like, excuse me, just refrain from speaking about me, please. But the end of the movie where they are battling Viggo on the inside with their proton packs.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, outside, Lewis is trying to break down the wall of slime.
Yeah, the barrier that's, you know, stopping them, that they that's why they had to use the Statue of Liberty. So
right, yeah. On the outside, and then when it finally explodes because the Ghostbusters have saved the day, and he thinks that he did it, was hilarious. Like, his reaction was priceless.
That was another feel good moment. Yes, yeah. I would agree.
Because he's like, yes, I'm a Ghostbuster, and, you know, and so. But I like the fact that even though, you know, in the third act, you see the Ghostbusters building momentum and starting to turn the tide. When they hit Viggo with the proton packs, he's able to, like, throw them away. Like, he's able
just kind of bats it away, and so you see that, you know, that's not something that's going to hurt him. So that was another trepidatious moment, because I remember seeing that in the theater and thinking, okay, well, what are they going to do if they can't hurt him with the proton packs?
Like, I love how even though he ultimately loses, he still comes off as very powerful.
Yeah, indeed.
And, like, even when he's in that in-between state where he's phasing in and out, you know, he's not a fully formed entity. He's kind of in between states, and he's going after the baby.
Yes, and you know, I'll say that too about his the effects when he's walking across the room, and he kind of, you know, and they give you that effect where it looks like he's kind of in I don't know, it's almost like a flash effect, like it's more than one Vigo, you know, that's kind of going in and out of reality, like he's moving, you know, between the seconds. And I just thought that was a stroke of brilliance too.
Yeah. So, but yeah, at the end of the day, the Ghostbusters, again, save the day. And they're once again being lauded as the heroes that they are.
And Lady Liberty is back where she should be at the end of the film. Yeah.
How she got back there, leave it to the movie magic to explain. But yeah, it ends on an uplifting note, and you know, Peter and Dana are a thing again, and the Ghostbusters are back, and it just has an uplifting ending montage, which I always love those, right?
Yes. We should point out that Slimer has a baby face turn in this. You see him give Lewis a ride at the end. Yes.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I forgot how little of Slimer there was in this, though, comparatively.
Yeah, there really wasn't a lot. Yeah.
I always remember him having a bigger role than he does.
Well, because he was marketed so much.
That's probably what it is.
There were Slimer toys everywhere in 1989, let me tell you.
Yeah, and the cartoon had a lot to do with it.
Yes, indeed.
Too, which we'll be covering in great detail.
Which we will be covering on the Multiverse Musings podcast network.
Yeah, that's right. There you go.
Home of Flash of Two Mics and the Emerald Echo.
Yeah. Remember, we're just playing them in today. But yeah, overall, is there anything that we haven't touched on that you want to touch on, Donnie, before we...
I will say, and again, this is going way back in the movie, during the courtroom scene, you know, the judge is the one who kind of activates the slime that brings forth the Scolari brothers.
He's getting so angry and frustrated.
He's so angry. I just remember being 16, and it reminded me of that old Tex Avery cartoon with the bear, Rockabye Bear.
Yes, I don't know.
Shut up! Quiet! I hear one more peep out of you, and I give me another watchdog.
Yeah. No, but as a first scene for the Ghostbusters, you know, in the first time they bust another ghost, or two in this case, it was a very, very strong re-entry for the Ghostbusters.
I would definitely agree. Like I said, I liked it almost as much as the first one. I just remember being very excited about it coming out and thinking that it was a very fitting continuation of the franchise.
Yeah, I agree. So, yeah, with that, I guess we can go ahead and give it a rating.
What kind of rating? Are we doing numbers or letters or...
I can't remember what we did the last time. I should have listened to that moment in the episode.
Apples and bananas.
Why don't we... Okay. Going forward, here's what we'll do.
We need a standardized rating thing.
All right. So for film and television...
Okay.
We'll do letter grades.
Letter grades, okay.
For comic books, we'll do number grades.
Number grades, okay.
So... With that being said, your letter grade for Ghostbusters 2.
I'm going to give it an A-. Like I said, you know, my main criticism really wasn't a lot having to do with the effects or really the villain or the interaction with the Ghostbusters. It was just kind of that clunky backstory with Dana. Again, I would have thought it would be more organic to say, okay, Oscar was actually Peter's baby and they tried things out and it didn't work and they were kind of, you know, trying to make things work for the sake of Oscar. And that's why, you know, they were still in one another's life as opposed to the backstory with, you know, the other man. But again, that's not a huge criticism.
Good point.
I'm just like you with shipping. It seems like Hollywood there's an over reliance on this will they or won't they. You know, there's always this, you know, again, that type of storyline. And to do that with previously established characters, I'm just like, okay, well, this didn't need to be here. There was a better way to go forward. But again, not a huge criticism.
Well, I think back then it was even less reliant. I mean, now it's like shows and movies cater to the shippers.
Oh, yes.
More so.
And sometimes it's good. Sometimes it's an organic thing, and then other times you're just like, "Does this really need to be here?" You know, there are other things in life than romance. So
yeah, like there's 24 hours in a day. Not all 24 have to be consumed with, you know, one thought.
How many hours a day do you spend thinking about Alexa Bliss? That's what I want to know.
Well, my thought process has to be all over the place because there's so many multiverse wives right. that I really have to give so many of them attention or thoughts during the day. There aren't enough hours in the day to give them all thoughts because there's a minimum of like 100.
You need to be on a 37-hour day like in Men in Black.
Yeah, or whatever Jor-El says, however many hours. 28 is even enough. Even Jor-El doesn't have enough for me.
For
me, I'm in the same boat as you. I'm gonna just give it I'll give it the same rating, A-. I enjoyed it. I thought some of the jokes were funnier in this one than they were in the original.
Yeah, they had some real funny jokes in this. They had ones that were very well executed. So
I liked that. You know, there was a different status quo for the Ghostbusters when the film started, and there was a progression back to unifying, right? As opposed to there could have been, hey, everything's great, we're still the Ghostbusters, and nothing at all has changed, which would have been kind of stale. So, yeah, overall, I was really happy with it. I think the music had more of an effect. Like, had a more of a pop culture effect in the first one than it did. I mean, no movie song from that franchise or very few from other franchises.
By the way, I think I'm just remembering that it was Auld Lang Syne, the New Year's, because it was New Year's Eve. It was the New Year's Eve song that they were singing at the end, the crowd.
At the very end, yeah.
Yes. The Bobby Brown song, I believe, is called Control or Take Control, something like that.
Yeah. But I think the soundtrack from that perspective hit harder in 84. But very few movie songs are going to hit like the Ghostbusters theme.
Oh, yeah. That's much like the first movie, Catching Lightning in a Bottle. The Ghostbusters theme is just timeless.
Yeah. So there it is. It's an A- for me. And I don't personally get the hate for it, if that's what you want to call it. But I still enjoy it, and it's been a while since I watched this one, and it was an enjoyable and fun rewatch. So glad we did it.
And you know, as a father, I've enjoyed sharing these movies with my children, and I will enjoy sharing them with my grandchildren someday. So
yes, and they will continue on for sure. Next up on our watch list will be Ghostbusters Answer the Call,
which is another movie that gets unnecessary hate.
And yeah, that was an interesting scenario way back in 2016. And we'll revisit some of that craziness on the next episode.
Indeed.
But until then, we hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you want to continue discussing the Ghostbusters franchise with Donnie or myself, you can via social media. So, Donnie, where can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter as the Emerald Enthusiast. If you would like to talk Ghostbusters or any kind of movies, anything involving, you know, sci-fi or fantasy, any nerdy kind of stuff, I'm always down for that. But in particular, things like Ghostbusters and comic books. You can find me on Twitter. I also have a YouTube channel that I just started that has product reviews of collectibles related to things like Green Lantern. And again, if you want to find me there, you can do so. I'm always happy to talk to people who listen to the Multiverse Musings podcast network, available on iTunes and Podbean.
Love it. Love it. We're going to start a drinking game every time Donnie does a plug.
But one thing I don't have is my muffin still, Alfred.
Yeah, or in this case, would it be Slimer for the purposes of this show?
Oh, no. Well, if he was Slimer, then he would eat my muffin, so that doesn't work.
Yeah, that doesn't work for you. We'll call you... I'm more of the Ray of the podcast. Sorry, I'm more of the Peter of the podcast, let's be honest.
Okay.
So you are, I would say you're more along the lines of Ray.
Okay, yeah, sure, I'll be Ray, yeah.
Steven can be Winston, that's going to get us in trouble. So that,
yeah, let's not go there, no.
I don't know that he's an Egon type either.
We can call him Lewis.
Yeah, Lewis, there you go, he's Lewis. Which I guess is a step up from Egon, Slimer. So Lewis, get Ray's muffin, and I'll be busy with Dana. But anyway, if you want to interact with me on Twitter, you can at @Adam_DeeceFan. And if Facebook is more your thing, you can request permission to join the Multiverse Musings Podcast Network Facebook page. I will add you to the group, and we can continue talking about the Ghostbusters there. We hope you enjoyed this podcast as much as Donnie and I enjoyed bringing it to you. And we hope you will join us next time. Until then, we want you to remember that Ghostbusters 2 is forever. From the first inappropriate sexual innuendo...
So long, everybody.
Don't cross the streams, and so long.
Something weird.